I have just simply entitled today's remarks, The Test. The story goes that there was an elderly man who was dying and laying on his bed. And while suffering agonies on his way to his final moments, he suddenly smelled the aroma of his favorite scones wafting up the stairs from the kitchen. He gathered whatever remaining strength he had. He lifted himself from the bed, and leaning on the wall, he slowly made his way out of the bedroom, gripping the wall, down the stairs, and slowly into the kitchen. And there, piled on a tray, were his favorite scones. Was this heaven, he wondered? Or was it one final act of love from his devoted wife of 60 years? Seeing to it that he would leave this world a happy man. Mustering one great final effort, he threw himself towards the table, landing on his knees in a rumpled posture. His aged and withered hand trembled toward a scone at the edge of the table, when it was suddenly smacked by his wife with a wooden spoon. "Oh, no, you don't," she said. "Therefore the funeral." Whenever we face suffering, no matter what kind of suffering it is, the first thing all of us want is comfort. If you have pain, you want pain relief. If you lose a loved one, you want them back. If you go broke, well, you want more money. Whatever deficit you are facing in what you consider to be a normal, contented life, we want it filled and to be comfortable. The portion of scripture before us today may shock us to our core, because first and foremost, we learn that for God, our comfort is not his top priority. Let me say that again. For God, our comfort is not his top priority. Today, the curtain is pulled back a little bit, so we catch a glimpse of the inner workings of God's court. Now, some of the ideas that I will be pulling from Job, especially today, may challenge you to rethink how you view God, the Satan, and even this world itself. But I think we can garner a much healthier view of life if we're brave enough to dive into this book of Job. In all of this series, there is one thing we must remember above everything else. This book is at its heart a testing of Job, and likely our testing as well. The truth we must garner here is that the glory of God is more important than your or my comfort. Perhaps intellectually we concur with this statement, but when the rubber meets the road, I'm not sure that we would agree. There are some pretty severe consequences to our faith and our lives if we believe God's glory is more important than our comfort. I almost guarantee that should we pursue this path, we may not like where it leads us. In our first step in meeting the book of Job, we saw this beautiful portrayal of a world as we believe it should be. The good prevail and even prosper, and the evil are punished. Job's experience now crushes that worldview to a pulp. And that is the whole point of this passage before us today. There was a day. The Bible says this was just a regular day, and Job's life will never be the same again. At first, things seem normal enough, don't they? God is holding court, and the sons of God, or the angelic beings, are presenting themselves to God. Sons of God, in this case, refer to supernatural beings that were created by God, something I already mentioned could be referred to as angels. The meaning of presenting themselves is kind of akin to a cabinet meeting where each angel gives an accounting of their activities and their observations. In Psalm 82 and also 89, we see references to God's counsel. Zechariah 6:5 has a similar portrayal as well. Out of this angelic group, only one is mentioned, and he is referred to as the Satan. Now, this is where we have to be very, very careful how we tread. You may have to jettison your understanding of Satan after today. The Satan is not a name. Rather, it is a title. It means something like adversary or opponent or enemy. Interestingly enough, and this may shock you, God himself is referred to as a Satan in Numbers 22, verse 22. Here we read that in stopping Balaam, God was his adversary, or Satan. It is often assumed that Satan is an evil being, but he's not portrayed that way here, despite what happens to Job. He is also not a gatecrasher to this counsel of God. There is no implied hostility between the Satan and God. From where have you come? God asks him. What is your report of the activities and observations that you have made? If you read 1 Kings 22, there's a beautiful picture of what's transpiring here. In that passage, we read that God sent a lying spirit to do his will. Satan is there because he's expected to be there. His role, roughly, is akin to Her Majesty's loyal opposition. In our parliament, oppositions are needed to keep the ruling party in good governance or accountable to the people. Now, I should tell you also that the images portrayed here are not to be taken literally. They are used because you and I, we can understand them. The picture here is of one true, absolute, supreme, and sovereign God who has no rivals, none. There is no other God beside him. That being said, we are led to understand that God, in his providence, doesn't do everything by his own hand, but through his creative design, he assigns to supernatural beings or angels tasks to be accomplished. Some of these beings may be seen as evil from our perception or malevolent, and we will see possibly why that is very shortly. But I want to be very clear that what's being presented in the book of Job is not a dualist portrayal that some religions have. In this portrayal, God is sovereign. But other agencies are at work in the world. This is really about governance, not fellowship. There is no hint that the Satan enjoys being in God's presence, but it is his duty. The Satan reports that he's been going to and fro over the earth. This is not aimless wandering, by the way, but rather it's a purposeful investigation. Satan is looking to see if there is anyone who truly is pious in this world, who is godly on the earth. This would suggest to us that that's his task, that's his job. God goes on and asks the Satan if he's noticed Job is a pious man. Boy, that's a bad thing for Job, isn't it? God calls Job his servant. It is a recognition of Job's loyalty to God and his honor before God. And the point of the book of Job now becomes clear. This is not a book about suffering, but rather about how God treats his friends. Satan sees an opening and pushes back. It's his job, remember. This is what he does. The Satan agrees that Job appears to love God, appears to be pious, But is his love sincere? Does he actually love God simply because of who God is, or because he gets something from being pious? Namely, all the wealth and privilege that we saw last week, or 2 weeks ago. Does God's finest servant, his showpiece of piety, really love God? The Satan then seals Job's fate by suggesting that God's really protecting him by putting a hedge around him. Job worships God, the Satan says, because of what he has, not because of who God is. It appears Job really is living the prosperity gospel. If you do everything right, and you will prosper. Now, what comes next, some have referred to a wager, but it's not a wager at all. It's a test. A test of Job's sincerity and his love. Stretch out your hand, the Satan says, and he will curse you to your face. In other words, take away his property and he will forgo his devotion. Now, let's be honest here. The Satan's logic is perfect. The Satan is challenging God to see if Job is really pious. Now, we have to be clear as well that the Satan's efforts are not based on malice, at least in this perception or perspective. He has a job to do, as do all the angelic beings. God's worthiness must be defended, even if it means we humans suffer terrible loss. As Peter writes in the New Testament, you have been grieved by various trials so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, that though perishable is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. God is worthy of our worship simply because he is God. God will be praised and his honor adored and his honor seen by the universe because Christian men and women have gone on worshiping him even when the blessings of their lives have been taken away. The glory of God is more important than your, my, or Job's comfort. That's at the very heart of this reality. God allows the Satan to go and do as he pleases, but not to touch Job. At first you think God's will only go so far in proving the piety of Job, but if Job dies, the whole exercise is moot. It is further eye-opening to realize that not one hair on Job's head can be touched without God's permission. And thus begins this terrible litany of troubles for Job. First of all, his children, who were celebrating one of their birthday celebrations, as I mentioned last week, it's something they did. And while this was occurring, a messenger arrives to tell Job that his oxen and donkeys were stolen, and the servants who were tending them were killed, all except the one who came to report. Oh, the protective hedge is breached, isn't it? Job had hardly caught his breath when another messenger appears and says that lightning fell from the sky and killed all his sheep, and all the servants who were tending the sheep, except the one who brought the report. But the bad news isn't over. Another messenger arrives to tell him that a raiding party has swooped in and stolen all his camels and killed the servants who were looking after them. Only he who brought the report is left alive. Job is now bankrupt. He has been liquidated of all his assets. Well, the worst is over, but it's not, is it? Remember that birthday party his children were enjoying? Well, the story goes that a great wind came out of the desert and collapsed the house, killing his children, all of them. And how will Job respond to this last piece of terrible news. All we're told is that Job arises, and in Middle Eastern fashion, he tears his robe, he shaves his head, and he falls on the ground and worships God. Job says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job knows that one day he will die. And God gives all the goodness, and it is God's prerogative to take all that goodness away. The story seems to conclude with the words, "In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong." But that's not the end of the story, is it? Once again, there's a council in heaven, it's meeting, and once again, the Satan comes in from his going to and fro over the earth. Once again, Job is put forward as an example of unconditional love towards God. "Not yet," the Satan declares. "Job still has his health. Take that away and he will surely curse you." So God gives him permission to strike Job's health, but again, not to take his life. We read that Job was infected with terrible sores or like boils. In all the other losses, other agents were at work. There was robbers, there was windstorms, etc. Now the Satan gets personal. He goes right at Job. The picture that emerges here is designed to provocatively to just show someone in the most pitiful state they could possibly be in. Job has hit rock bottom. He sits in ashes, scraping the sores on his body with pottery shards. He's lost everything. But will he still worship God after God took away everything? But there's still one more trial here, one we often overlook. While he's sitting on that ash heap, scraping his sores, his wife comes to him. She sees the pitiful state of her husband. This is the only time we ever hear from his wife. It's the only part she plays in the story. We have to remind ourselves that she too is grieving the loss of her children. She's in great pain. She too is feeling alone. Her life of luxury and influence and whatever respect she had garnered by being Job's wife are all now gone. So what does she do out of her anguish? She chastises Job, not out of malice, but out of her own pain. She sees the pitiful man that she has loved and admired become a shadow of what he once was. She begs him to forego his integrity, to curse God and die. "What has all these sacrifices you've done over these years gained you?" she wonders. "Just end this and find peace in death." Job, though, will not succumb, but in kindness says to his wife that her suggestion is not worthy of her. "Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil?" The conclusion of this passage is powerful. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Job would not do as the Satan said he would. He has passed the test. Boy, what an awful cost, though. Financial ruin and so much death, children and servants. As I mentioned at the beginning of today's message, the glory of God is more important than our comfort. Job reveals that for the glory of God, there should be only one person in the world who worships God because God is worthy of worship. For no other reason than God is God. This is a critical moment in the story. This is the break between what Job has experienced and now the visit of his friends. I should reiterate that the book of Job is a book about extremes. One minute Job's on top of the world and the next he's on a heap of ashes scraping boils. and all of it in just a few days. For us, the question arises that as deep as our suffering is, it surely cannot even come close to the overwhelming suffering of Job. We have never been as great as Job, nor likely as fallen as he is. Neither have we been as happy or so alone, so rich or so poor, or neither so pious. This brings in the most critical point of all. Job actually does not foreshadow you and I as much as one who actually was truly blameless, in fact sinless, and suffered in spite of his sinless nature, namely Jesus. And you know, Jesus was degraded, he was beaten, he was hung shamelessly on a cross. So Job's story here is a foreshadow of Jesus' crushing suffering. But there is another critical lesson to learn here. Something Jesus said to Peter and in turn all the other disciples. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. Just as Satan wanted to sift Job, he also wanted to sift those apostles. Jesus goes on and says, but I prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Peter in his own letter writes that trials are a necessary thing so that we are tested for the genuineness of our faith. Do we love God for who God is, or just because of what God gives us? And Peter warned us that your adversary, Satan, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking to devour, and he can be resisted only by faith. Paul tells us to put on the whole armor of God to withstand the schemes of the adversary. I don't know about you, but when I read the book of Job, I find it a very scary story. It's like a horror story. The truth is that Job's story is and can be our story. It can be a personal horror story. However, there is a big difference between Job and ourselves, an important difference. A huge, monumental, life-changing difference. You and I, we live after the cross, after the fulfillment of Job's story. God has disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to shame all through the cross of Christ. In First John 3 verse 8, we read that the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the work of the devil. To make sure the accuser does not have the final word on any one of us, the cross changes everything. In Revelations 12, we're told how the cross ended the Satan and the other accuser's place in God's counsel. That does not mean that the accuser is still not at work, but rather that because of Christ, he is no longer in God's throne room accusing you and I. The issue of our justification is settled. There is no condemnation, Paul says in Romans 8. So as we explore the story of Job, we're also exploring the story of Jesus. Satan still prowls around looking to devour us. We still have to endure. As Revelations 13 says, we need to continue in endurance and faith. If we are Christ, the Satan is no longer able to accuse us because he no longer has access to the throne of God. As Jesus said from the cross, it is finished. The story of Job just lets us know exactly what was finished.